Today we're going to dive in just a little bit from some goings-on around our nation. So there's your heads up. We got a good set of passages to dive into that on, but I'll leave it there for now, leave you on the edge of your seat. I am a child of the 90s. I was born in the 80s, but really my first bits of consciousness and awareness were things like my first album, Green Day, the Y2K panic when everyone thought the world was going to explode because we couldn't handle the digits 2000. I remember the Cowboys and the Yankees. I'm big fans of those teams because in the 90s, they were crushing it on TV. They were winning all kinds of championships. So I was shaped as a preteen, captivated by all of these different stories. In the later 90s, I was also shaped and captivated by Bill Clinton, who was a president, kind of the golden boy of the Democratic Party, this Southerner who was well-spoken, charming, politically successful, achieving all kinds of goals. I was shaped by his presidency and his biggest failure. My whole generation is going to be sensitive to the phrase, I did not have sexual relations with that woman. That just rings clear for anyone growing up in that time. I was shaped by his failures in part because I remember looking around and being very aware of how people were reacting. How do people respond when something like this happens with our president? I was captivated by a salacious story, and I saw responses all around. Some folks, of course, would rally to his support and say, well, you know, what somebody does in private is a different thing than what they do in their public office of service, okay? Others, often outraged, castigated him because he is the ruler of the free world and yet was being such a poor moral example, okay? In both responses, I was being taught something about life. If you're successful, charming, winsome enough, then your private choices don't really matter. Or the good life means living a moral life, no matter what's going on the outside, that right moral set of choices is going to mean the good life. Today we meet Jesus doing a similar thing in the Beatitudes. He's pointing out what the good life is. It's the beginning of his Sermon on the Mount, which is just beautiful. This is why I hope we get to spend a lot more time in the Sermon on the Mount, maybe at some point later in the summer. This is just a beautiful set of, well, I mean, it's Jesus' sermon, so, you know, what am I going to say is going to make it any better? But it's a pretty good one. But he depicts the good life in some pretty surprising ways. You know, look at all of the blesseds, which we will in a moment here. Who is he calling blessed? It's so surprising, and I don't think we really believe him. I grew up in and around the church, and so I was also listening for how folks in the church around the nation responded to Bill Clinton's debacle, and followers of Jesus were very much on either side of this thing. Rightly so, this is important. The ways that we as a church, as a nation even, respond when, you know, when something like this happens, it's teaching ourselves what the good life is. It's teaching the world around us what the good life is. Certainly it's teaching our kids what the good life is. What do we functionally, practically believe? So Jesus is doing the same thing today, describing the fabric of the good life as existing with the poor, the afflicted, the makers of peace, the grieving. So here's where we're going to camp out. Our lives are always teaching about the good life. Whose good life is it that we believe in? And how do we practically set out to believe in it? The good life. Where do I get this phrase from? The good life is shorthand, you know, philosophers, folks all over the place have always sought to depict the good life. You know, different philosophies pointing you towards what would make life good, having things set up. In our translations, usually we get 9 sets of blesseds. Blessed are, blessed is, blessed is, blessed are. This is an unhelpful translation of the underlying Greek word. I'm thankful to the Bible Project. They have a 40-part podcast series on the Sermon on the Mount, and they really do a deep dive into this. So if you're really curious, go there. But it's an unhelpful translation to say blessed. Biblical blessing is a thing. The Hebrew word baruch has to do with physical manifestations of safety, abundance, security. It's stuff that we might pray for one another, for ourselves, for our kids. And it's something that only God can do. We actually cannot whip up our own blessing, baruch, in this way. You look at Genesis chapters 1 and 2. Those two quick chapters there before it all goes haywire. Blessing. Walking closely with God, closely with each other, have everything they need in utter security. If blessing is what Jesus means here, then it kind of feels like he doesn't really get us. Isn't that right? Blessed are those who are afflicted, who are poor. Safety and security and abundance have those who have nothing. I don't know that that's the kind of rescuer that I would really want to follow if that's what he's saying. It's not what Jesus is referring to here. And we know this because the underlying Greek word that's used is this word makarioi. Makarioi. This is the word that translators of the Hebrew Bible into Greek use not for the word blessing, but for the word the good life belongs to. It's the best gloss that we can come up with. This word is ashrei. For anybody who was on the Zoom last Sunday, you'll remember hearing it, ashrei. It's slightly different in meaning, but it's really important. Ashrei has less to do with the goods of security and abundance. It has more to do with this idea of somebody standing on the outside of somebody else's situation and saying, that's the good life. That's the way to live. For example, look at Psalm 1. Many of us might know the way it begins. Blessed is the one who doesn't walk with the wicked, but it's not baruch. It's ashrei. Blessed, or the good life, belongs to the one who doesn't walk with the wicked. And they are fruitful, the psalm goes on, in all seasons, even the ones that are fallow, because they are planted by streams of living water. Ashrei, person is pointing to another, saying, that's the good life. At the end of Psalm 2, blessed, not baruch, ashrei, are those who take refuge in Yahweh in a dangerous situation. You can have the good life even when things are going haywire. Take refuge in Yahweh. Ashrei. That's the good life. We see it elsewhere when the Queen of Sheba visits Solomon in the Old Testament, and the Queen of Sheba recognizes his wisdom, recognizes the abundance of their nation, and says, ashrei are your people to be under your leadership. She's pointing out their situation and saying, that is the good life. Ashrei means a person standing outside of another's situation and describing that set of circumstances as the good life, or the way to the blessed life. And we see this all over the place. There are examples of this in literature around Jesus' time. So the book of Ecclesiasticus, a young Jewish scholar was writing in the 2nd century BC, so before Jesus, said, Ashrei is the one who rejoices in his children, who finds a friend. All right, so like depicting what the good life is in all these ways. Who lives with a reasonable wife? Ashrei. Blessed is the one who speaks and people listen, who lives to see the downfall of his enemies. You see a little bit of a wrestling with and a description of sort of the comforts of life in this depiction of the good life. But this is kind of the idea of Ashrei, as we see around Jesus' time. I'm going to bring it home. I'm really going to drive this because it's a slight shift in our understanding of what Jesus is doing here, but I think it's important to catch. Bring it home. Appalachian Ashrei. Have a house on the mountain, not too far away, but secluded. You can't see anyone else. Have your own well, perhaps a backup generator, especially lately. Solar panels, battery backup. You don't need to rely on anybody for anything. Ashrei. Haywood, Ashrei, maybe you're 75 years old, you're still able to go on a hike with your teenage grandkids, and they are open to your wisdom that you have to share. You can almost see them maturing in front of you as you speak. Ashrei. One last example, then I'll leave it. The King family Ashrei. We live on a street with 8 other kids that our kids like running around with. It's also a dead-end street, so there's very little traffic. And we actually like the parents of the other kids. Ashrei. Right? In part, not fully, but Ashrei. The good life. It's what it looks like, at least in partial expression. This is what Jesus is getting at when he said, blessed is. Makarioi is. And so when Jesus describes the good life, the creator of life, then I think we need to listen especially. What he's doing is giving a description of the good life, not a prescription for us to follow. Here are the places, in other words, that you are most likely to see the kingdom that I am bringing. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is not prescribing a holy checklist. And I think we've actually wrestled with this before. Are we really supposed to seek being impoverished? Are we supposed to seek out mourning and grieving? Is that the good life? Is that what Jesus has on offer for us? If we think of it as a holiness checklist, that can get a little funny in our spirituality some. But he is describing the kinds of people and their circumstances that are more likely to receive the truest blessing possible, the kingdom of God, the comfort of God, being called children of God. It is not super clear what to do with that. But what is clear is that he's surrounded by the very people he's talking about in this instance. If you read the end of chapter 4, you'll notice everybody that he's just been healing all around Galilee, which was a very diverse culture, all around the Decapolis, the 10 cities. Lots of different kinds of people from lots of different places, mostly people who are especially needy, come to him, find healing in him, and then keep following him around. This is who he's surrounded by. He's teaching his disciples, hey, here's why we're spending so much time with these people. Because they might have expected that they would spend more of their time with the people who are on the upswing in society. In a way, he's saying, if we were to join forces with the people on the upswing in society, we'd be likely to miss out on the kingdom, which is right here. Right around us. It's interesting to observe, unique among religions, what Jesus is doing here is actually creating a space of honor for suffering. Suffering is such an incredibly difficult thing, but no other faith has an answer for how hard it is to go through being persecuted, to go through being sick. There is a suffering that is hard to know what to do with. But Jesus puts his finger on folks who are going through it and says, there is something of the kingdom closeness to those who suffer. The big question then would have been, how is Jesus, this prophet, this Messiah, going to live this out? Sorry, I have a noisy water bottle. How is he going to live this out? As we know, Jesus would go on to utterly live out this fabric of the kingdom. He would utterly make peace. I hope you know he's not keeping peace. He's inserting himself in places where peace needs to be made, where it is currently not. He would utterly be merciful to those around him. He'd be utterly meek, as we heard in our psalm today, meekness. We don't really know what to do with that word, but it inherently means to be utterly powerless to do anything about changing your situation. You do not have a single finger on a lever of power around you. He would be merciful as he would be driven to the cross to discover blessing of the kingdom for anybody who would receive it. Jesus was utterly driven by those who were on the outs, who could not change anything about their own circumstance. Can you not hear us in that? Blessed are those who actually cannot help themselves, however hard they try. That's what drives him. And when we realize it, somehow mysteriously we are closer to the kingdom. So, the Beatitudes are not a checklist, but they are describing a fabric that will become more comfortable with us and in us the longer that we are kingdom people. If we find ourselves moving in the other direction, a yellow flag should go up in our minds. Today, we try to live in such a way, I think, that others might look at us and say, Ashrei. We seek the ashrei. This is not good for us. We seek that high view of other people, even the best people, but this is actually not the best way to live. This is not the good life. Living for the approval of others is leaving ourselves up to fickleness, fallible people who are not meant to bear the weight of our receiving of the good life. Case in point, 2 decades after Bill Clinton's debacle, the same groups of folks are speaking up, in many cases the same exact folks, to make the almost exact opposite arguments when it's politically advantageous. All of a sudden, progressives care more about personal morality, public and private coming together than they did 20 years prior. All of a sudden, conservatives are willing to allow for a little bit of space between what somebody does in their public office and in their private lives. Say, well, we don't need a saint to be our president. More than anything, you know, if we wonder why my generation, millennials, if you were wondering, seem to avoid church, I wonder at times if it is not because we've embodied the message that the good life means being politically in charge. That's certainly a message that I received. Have you ever interpreted an event a certain way because you know that's how your party thinks? Have you ever pulled up from criticizing someone because they're on your team? Have you ever gone along with something even though your Christ-centered heart has reservations? this is ashrei seeking, and I think it's unhelpful. I know, because I've participated in it. Let us not seek the ashrei, but seek the kingdom. So Jesus is not prescribing a holiness checklist, but he is describing the places we are most likely to find the kingdom. If we find ourselves against those described here, we should be very careful, because we might accidentally find that we are among those who say, "Lord, Lord," without being known by him. Blessed are the poor, the powerless. Theirs is the kingdom. Our current president has also abused his power. His use of an image this week at the tail end of a social media post depicting Barack and Michelle Obama as apes is racist. It is dehumanizing. It is tarnishing the image of God in those two people whose politics I may or may not agree with. But they are image bearers like anybody else. His post is so dangerous because it seems to be tapping back into imagery and verbiage that this nation has worked centuries to try to put behind us. It is giving license to certain folks who might have an inclination towards putting folks more on the outside. It's giving them license to ignore their better angels. It is hard to imagine what's motivating this. I feel myself wanting to caveat left and right. This is part of why I don't like talking politics in a message. It's just not the time to nuance it the ways that it needs to be nuanced. But this is not a nuance. There are times when things are done that are just wrong. This image, I find myself wanting to put it to the side, like maybe it was a young staffer who did it and Donald didn't really know about what was going on. It is hard to hold this up against everything that's going on around the nation to folks of different colored skin right now. There is a seemingly marginalizing spirit about our politics right now. I do think he has taken advantage of the votes of many people who gave him a mandate to get this immigration situation under control, which it needs to be. Nobody has had the answer to this thing in decades and decades. But he was given a mandate to bring control where there has been chaos previously. But he's just brought us a different kind of chaos. This recent post has dehumanized and marginalized a large part of our nation. Those are the folks who are on the outskirts already. Those are the folks that we need especially to move towards, because theirs is the kingdom. Those are the folks that gathered around Jesus. They're not morally any better or worse, but because of what they have been going through, they are more prone to see their need for the kingdom. We need to move towards them, to see them, and certainly not find ourselves on the opposite side of a lot of difficulty being made in their lives. A lot more could be said, and I'm going to say here, I would love to say a lot more and have a lot more of a conversation. Our final topic in our Pub Theology series was all around spiritual disciplines for political theology. We need to be able to know how our faith and our politics come together. Suffice it to say, Jesus' kingdom, in his words, is not of this world, but it is for this world. So let's follow his depiction of where the kingdom can be found and expect to find it there. There's one way here at the end that I believe we can actively participate in this fabric that Jesus is weaving here. I love the call, his invitation that says, the good life belongs to those who grieve. To grieve means to recognize a death, to process it, to feel what we are feeling in it, and to recognize the new reality on the other side of it, in short. And so we can grieve. And there is not a one of us who is left outside of the call to grieve in this situation. Certainly those who have at any time put their support behind the man who has put these racist marks out there. Yes, grieve them. Grieve what's going on. Grieve the way that he's taken advantage of your votes. Grieve the ways that we might have downplayed the need for personal morality in pursuit of political advantage. Not just with our vote, but in continuing to defend. Blessed are those who grieve. For those who are against our president currently, blessed are those who grieve. Have our hearts been pure in this? When we respond with smugness instead of sadness, aren't we just making it worse, perpetuating this back and forth seeking of being politically in charge? We're perpetuating the cycle. We have divorced the good life of Jesus from our politics, but we refuse to grieve the poor decisions of our own parties, censoring the other party's voice, willfully ignoring different topics that have been really problematic, like immigration. Blessed are those who grieve. Why? They will receive comfort. They will receive the comfort of the kingdom. For those who are apolitical, which, again, I'm mostly speaking to my generation here, blessed are those who grieve. We tend to call ourselves politically homeless because, as we're finding in real home ownership, again, millennials, once you have a home, you have responsibility for your home. Our apathy in these times is as shocking as Jesus' upside-down beatitudes. Only half of our nation voted in this last election. Do you know how desperately the meek and the poor in spirit and the helpless and the persecuted would have longed to have a vote, even a small voice in how their government is acting? We can't give this up. Blessed are those who grieve. This is why we say confession every single Sunday together. This is why in 2 weeks' time, for the start of Lent, we'll pray the Great Litany together. This beautiful series of prayers that actually draws folks of whatever persuasion together to recognize we all have a hand in the brokenness of the world. Grieving means recognizing a death, that there are things that are wrong but need to be made right. It is the way to be in the world as a follower of Jesus, because the world is broken. If we are not grieving on the regular, then we are not paying attention. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. May we be counted among them. May we draw near to them. Amen.